Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for listening to Milk Street Radio. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to get our recipes, to stream our television show, or to get our latest cookbooks. Here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
The good chef is not necessarily a good teacher. I find myself always learning the new recipe to teach my student.
That was Chef Chengpao Hua. For the last 30 years, she's been on a mission to investigate, test, and preserve classic Taiwanese street food. Her students, many of them professionals, often end up cooking and selling street food for a living, continuing that long tradition of Taipei. I'll be speaking to reporter Jason Strother about his trip to Taipei and his interview with Chef Chengpao Hua in just a bit. But first, Maria Godoy, senior editor at NPR Science Desk and also host of The Salt, is here to talk about Shonen Knife, the punk Japanese band that has garnered a cult following for its songs about food. Maria, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
So I guess the pop quiz is which band plays songs entitled Strawberry Cream Puff, Sushi Bar, Wasabi, and Ramen Rock. What band would that be?
That would be Japan's legendary Shonen Knife. There are three women, and they've been around since 1981. They're from Japan. They formed in Osaka in 1981, and they've gone through a lot of members, but the two core are sisters, Atsuko and Naoko. Naoko is a front woman. And they basically were like clerks in Japan in the 80s, inspired by the Ramones, and they started doing this pop-punk thing, and they've got a big cult following.
I actually went to YouTube, of course, to research this, and like them. Maybe you could just describe the style somehow.
I would describe it as like Ramones meets, I don't know, Judas Priest sometimes, meets Britney Spears, maybe you could say. It's very catchy and playful and whimsical. They're infectious, I think is the word that I would use. They just sort of like make you happy to be alive. And obviously, they sing about something that we all love, which is food.
Now, I read that they were asked to go on tour with Nirvana in 91, but they said no, right?
No. They toured in 91 with Nirvana, and they also toured again. I think it was a UK smaller venues. And then in 93, they toured with Nirvana again and the Breeders, and it was stadium tours. They were one of the actually top 50 all-time bands for Kurt Cobain. If you look at his...
Really?
He had this list. Yeah, he had this... He was a huge admirer of them. Huh. If you look at old interviews, he would rave about Shonen Knife constantly. But that's when they got to know each other in 91. Naoko told me, when Kurt Cobain asked her to tour, at first she was a little bit scared because they looked wild with all their grunge look, like the unwashed grunge look of the early 90s.
So they had a 2017 USA Ramen Adventure Tour. What was that?
Well, as Naoko told me, sushi's already big, but ramen is getting hot now. And so they were riding the ramen wave. By night, they were playing gigs all across the U.S. By day, they were sampling ramen in different U.S. cities, which is not a bad way to tour, if you ask me.
What does the name Shonen Knife mean, actually?
I believe it refers to, like, a pocket knife, that like a boy's pocket knife. Hmm. But, you know, here's the one thing. There's a lot of new generation of Shonen Knife listeners, including my children, because their songs are so much fun to sing along to. Like, they have this song, Banana Chips, and when I was reporting this story, my kids, who are 3 and 7, were just running around the house singing it all day long.
So why are they focused on food as the sort of theme of the band?
You know, I asked that, and it's one of the themes. But when I asked Naoko, when she started out, she was pretty shy And singing about love songs, which is the standard stuff of songs, was really embarrassing to her. She is just like not a topic she felt comfortable singing about in public. But food was something that pretty much everybody could relate to and that was pretty important in her life. So that's what she clung to, and it's worked.
And your favorite food-related song, sushi bar, wasabi, ramen rock, brown mushroom, what's the one you like best?
I would think Ramen Rock because it's like a very empowering, almost feminist anthem about a bowl of ramen.
You're going to have to explain how a song about a bowl of ramen is, in fact, empowering.
Okay. The lyrics go, ramen noodles touch the power. And it's actually about them going out and eating ramen after shows. And I just think you listen to it. It's such a hard, like, the hard guitar in it. It makes you want to rock out. And I don't know. It makes you feel, like, very punk rock. I'm gonna tell my favorite food.
It's perfect after the show. A bowl of ramen, a song called Banana Chips, and people who've been on the road for 35 years.
And unless it's not just people, it's women in rock for 35 years.
That's,
you know,
true.
I think we got to give them props for that to keep going.
I will never eat a bowl of ramen again with the same point of view. Maria, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
That was Maria Godoy, senior editor, NPR Science Desk, and also host of The Salt. As always, you can subscribe and listen to Milk Street Radio as a podcast. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, also on Spotify. Now let's take your culinary questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Of course, she's the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television, also author of the book Home Cooking 101. Sarah, how are you?
I'm great, Chris, and I think it's time to get to the phones.
Open up the lines. Let's go.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who do we have on the line?
Hi, my name is Laura Shepherd. I'm calling from Maryland.
Hi, and I'm sure you have a thorny question for us.
I just appreciate you taking my call because I do.
Okay.
In regard to pleasing my husband, so of utmost importance.
Oh, always.
He really doesn't like dark meat chicken, so I do a lot of chicken breast. I guess I've mostly gone by, you know, sometimes using the thermometer, but also just, you know, cutting into the meat and seeing the juices run clear and the color white throughout. I've taken that to be a sign of doneness of a chicken breast. But he's complained sometimes about rubbery chicken, and he's squeamish that it's not cooked through and he's going to get sick. So I'm just wondering if there is an explanation for what he's calling rubbery chicken, if it has to do with the texture or if it is actually underdone and there's a different way that I can be testing.
Instant read thermometer would be the only good way to do it. And make sure you put it in horizontally and do it three or four different places. But you should get 160 to 165, and then there's no argument. You can even look pink sometimes in the center, even though it is actually cooked. So instant read thermometer is the way to go.
Do you think there's a chance that you've overcooked it and that's why it's more chewy?
Well, I've wondered that, too, but his solution to the rubberiness is to nuke it, just
to make sure
there's no salmonella or something, and then he's convinced he's not going to die. So,
well, there's two issues here. You know, you can't have it both ways. I actually was going to suggest that maybe the issue is your husband, not the chicken. I hate to do that because you sound very happily married, but let me just say this. If he really wants to get rid of the salmonella, cook it to death, but then it's going to be very chewy and dry.
No, I have a suggestion. You can either sous vide it.
I was going to say sous vide.
For like $100, $150, you can buy one of those sous vide towers, you know, and put that in any pot of water and set it to 165 and put the chicken or the turkey breast in a bag, press out the air, and just cook it. And you can cook it for a couple hours. It'll never overcook.
Really? Okay.
The other thing you can do is do a fake sous vide, put it in a bag, try to press out the air, put it in the water, bring the temperature up to about 175, and let it sit there. The other thing you can do, my favorite thing, is get a whole chicken, put it in 4.5 cups of water, add 2 cups of very dry sherry, some ginger and scallions, and bring that up to a simmer, add the chicken, cook it for 15 minutes, breast side down, flip it breast side up for 10 minutes. So that's 25 minutes total. Turn off the heat and let it sit for about half an hour. and it will always cook perfectly to 160, 165.
But the trouble is the husband doesn't like dark meat.
Well, he can have the white meat and she can have the dark meat. It's, Jack Spratt would eat no fat. I mean, you know, it's the perfect marriage.
Yes.
Well, thanks for the reminder about that. I appreciate it. I've forgotten. I've done it, you know, once or twice and then forgot. So that's helpful.
It's not good for that much. I mean, I wouldn't do a steak that way. But chicken, yeah.
Sure.
Anyway, sous vide is the way to go
right.
for that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Best wishes.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who do we have calling?
Hi, it's Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth. How can we help you?
First of all, I just want to say that you and Chris make a fantastic duo. I love this segment of Milk Street Radio. It's the best.
Oh, thank you.
So, first of all, a statistic. In 2014, nearly one in every four households in the United States were single-person households.
Wow.
I want to talk about the single-person households, the people who are eating three meals a day by themselves, trying to keep it interesting. And if they're like me, they don't want to fill the freezer with a bunch of doodads, usually unidentifiable, in a little while. I'm a personal chef, and I'm interested in learning more about how I might come home at the end of a day and feed myself, cut down on the packaging, and cut down all of the waste that goes on and on.
Well, a few recipe ideas. I would use a rice bowl and a noodle bowl. Okay. I make rice a lot, and then you have something simple you can put on it, including a leftover combined with different ingredients, the same with noodles. And finally, when I freeze in one-person portion or two-person portions.
Oh, no.
And that's, if you're making soup or stew, that makes some sense too. But I think in terms of a bowl, I don't think about a meat and two veg. So I have noodles, I have rice, or a simple soup. And I just put a little bit of something interesting on top of that. But that's the way I would cook if I was cooking just for myself.
Hmm. Elizabeth, I'm interested that you're anti-freezer because the freezer is really your best friend.
Well,
I just love leftovers because then you don't have to start from scratch. You just look at something, you're like, oh, I'll shred that up and throw that in a taco or, you know, or an egg dish. Egg dishes are wonderful, too. They're a vehicle for all sorts of leftovers, like a frittata you can throw anything into. Or just make some quick soup, you know, like Chris was suggesting, and throw in some shredded chicken and some vegetables. I think soup is the best vehicle on the planet.
It's the one thing I don't eat very much of at all.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I really don't.
The question is how to cook for one in a way that suits you. You don't want leftovers. You don't want the freezer. What kind of cooking would suit you for that?
Well, I love to grill.
Well, there you go.
And if I'm going to light the grill for one person, I'm going to do, you know, 10 chicken thighs that have been marinating for a little bit, and 9 of them end up in the freezer. And that's not a bad thing, you guys, really. It's not a bad thing, but it's not what I prefer to do.
The only other alternative is to buy very small quantities every day of whatever you want, and then you don't have a lot of leftovers, right? You can get one chop, or you could get one chicken breast, or you can get two or three thighs, you know.
Right.
I think in America, we're starting to think about dinner differently.
I was going to say rethink
eggs,
dinner.
Every culture uses
breakfast
eggs.
For dinner.
A frittata. The Japanese have really interesting forms of omelets. You can do a million different dishes just with eggs, and they all taste totally different.
Rethink supper.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yes.
There you go.
Okay. So in 2030, should we talk again?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sounds like a plan.
I think in 6 months, we should all go look at each other's freezer.
Yes.
See all the stuff that's been in there that we're now going to throw out.
So. Yes.
Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. You guys keep on doing the work you're doing. It's so appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a pressing culinary question, give us a ring. 855-426-9843. One more time. 855-426-9843. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
This is Candace Yamagata, and I'm from Washington, Utah.
How can we help you today?
I am a left-handed cook, not a very good cook, but a cook, and I have not been able to find a serrated knife that is beveled for a left-handed person. I've asked knife experts about left-handed knives and have been told there is no difference. And I agree with that when cutting with a knife that is beveled on both sides like Japanese knives are. But with a serrated knife, to me, it makes a difference.
Well, I'm also left-handed. Let me ask you a question. Oh. So when you're slicing with a serrated knife, what happens?
If I slice, say, a tomato, the bevel is on the right side, so the knife kind of swings out away from the meat of the tomato. Uh-huh. So the slice sometimes comes out thinner on the bottom because it's curving to the right.
There are some left-handed stores.
No, hold on.
No, this is true.
No, I know, but I'm right-handed, so I'm being introduced to this murky world. So I didn't know a serrated knife had a bevel. Let's just start with that. Is that true? It's beveled?
Yes, they are. Huh. You know what, Candace, I've always just powered on and not worried about it very much.
I think it's the handle on a Japanese knife that's the issue, not the blade.
If I look at my Japanese knives, they are beveled on both sides.
Yeah.
And I think you have talked to them about the angle of the bevel.
Right.
So it's even on both sides.
Right. It is.
So when I cut with that, I'm fine both ways. It's just the serrated that kind of swings out away from
That's really interesting.
Right. There are some stores that make completely left-handed stuff. If you Google, you know, left-handers, you will find them. And I know they sell knives as well. And I bet you they sell serrated knives.
Well, Sarah, it's good to know that you're left-handed and you just power on. And maybe that's what I
need to do
looking for something.
But we have to get to know Sarah, though. I mean, when it comes to something like that, that's what Sarah would do, right?
Well, you know, I've got bigger issues, like scissors. I'd like a left-handed pair of scissors. I know those exist, too, but I can't be bothered to buy one.
I sew, and so I have a pair of professional left-handed Fiskars, and I don't loan them to anybody.
Right.
Because if somebody right-handed tries to cut with those, they'll
mess it up.
That's what I'm getting Sarah for Christmas.
Yes, yes. That is what I need.
Well, that's actually, I want to go check that out. I never knew that about
serrated knives.
Serrated knives, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Candace, you know, we're very special. We're only 1 in 10. And we're very creative. Very creative. Einstein was left-handed.
So Sarah's walking down the street going, I'm left-handed, I'm just like Einstein? What?
No, it's just we're very special. We need to stick together. You
and Candace are very special.
Okay. At any rate, Candace, just Google left-handed stores. You'll find what you want.
Okay.
Or power on.
Well, no.
So
may I just say one thing,
all right,
though? You want to get a really good serrated knife. There's a lot of lousy serrated knives out
there.
So
sure.
I would rather use a really good bread knife or serrated knife that's right-handed. So you want to make sure you get a good quality knife.
Yeah, he may have a point there.
Yes, and I agree with that. And so maybe the powering on is just the answer
to go.
That.
Yeah.
Candace, thank you very much for calling.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, Milk Street heads to a cooking school in Taiwan to learn about bringing the spirit of classic flavors of street food to the modern kitchen. After the break. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, we're headed to the Chung Hua Culinary Teaching Center in Taipei, Taiwan. The owner, Chung Pao Hua, is a street food chef gone cooking school instructor who is now bringing the street to the classroom. She's teaching one student how to make Taiwanese hamburger patties.
Make sure you put enough cooking oil. Otherwise, the meat will stick it to the pan.
Today, I have reporter Jason Strother here in the studio. He's going to tell me about what he learned at the cooking school. Jason, how are you?
Not too bad, Chris.
So I gather that the old style of cooking is coming back in Taiwan, and you interviewed a culinary instructor who's, I guess, taught a lot of the chefs and street vendors over there in the old ways of cooking.
That's right, Chris. I recently visited Chef Chung Pao Hua. She runs a culinary institute in Taiwan where she teaches chefs how to make old-style Taiwanese dishes. The concept is called guzhawei. It's really hard to translate it. I asked her to give me her best shot at that.
It's hard to define guzhawei. Normally, we would say it's a generation passed down to generations recipe. Today's cooking has become more fast food style. Guzhawei just mean taking the time to prep the food and also to preserve that flavor.
Now, I did a little research on her, and it sounds like some of the students were looking for work. That is, they were in the financial district. It was just hard to find a job. Some of them will actually go out and do food stands on the street, right?
Right. Most of her students are chefs themselves. They run street stalls in Taipei. And one of the best things about visiting the Taiwanese capital is its street food. In any neighborhood, you'll have outdoor markets with dozens of these tiny little kiosks. And Chef Chuang teaches these chefs how to make their food, you know, embodying this Guzhaowei sort of taste.
So could you take us through one of these markets? If you're walking down New York, you'll see a falafel vendor, a hot dog vendor, a sausage vendor occasionally, pretzels. But this is a wholly different thing. So just take us down a block or two if you're walking by.
You go onto an alley, and for about a 100-yard stretch, you'll find food stall by food stall, taking up the entire alleyway. Each vendor specializes in a different dish. That could be steamed dumplings. That could be some kind of braised grilled duck. That could be stinky tofu, deep fried chicken patties, you name it.
So is there more to it than this? That is, we're talking about recipes that used to be passed down. Is this part of a culture that is taking a fresh look at its past? Or have the Taiwanese entirely moved into the 21st century and are not particularly interested in what happened before?
Taipei has a very cosmopolitan food scene, Chris. Anywhere in the city, you can find restaurants from all over the world. There are many Japanese restaurants, Thai restaurants, Italian restaurants. Jamie Oliver has an Italian place in a very big shopping mall in downtown Taipei. But it's in these back alleys behind the big boulevards that you find these street markets.
Now, I also read that I guess she's had 70,000 students pass through her courses over the decades. Did you chat with any of them? And what did they say about the process?
When I visited Chef Chuang's school, a class was underway. I got to speak with some of her students, including a gentleman, Mr. Wu, who actually lives in Dusseldorf, Germany, and runs a Taiwanese restaurant there. He's learned everything he knows about food from Chef Chuang and comes back every so often to learn what the new street food craze is.
You know, stinky tofu, I still cannot make in Germany because it really too stinky, they say, the way they won't allow me to do it. So this is one of the most I'm missing really in Germany because I cannot do it right now.
So when you go to Taipei, what you name two or three things you just love to eat there?
You know, Chris, when I go there, I meet up with an old Taiwanese friend of mine, and I let her do all the ordering, and I do the eating. I know on a recent trip, I enjoyed a bowl of steamed crab dumplings, a bowl of a noodle soup with some brisket. But my favorite street food dish is called chi pai, which I believe means chicken steak. It is a big frisbee-sized piece of chicken that has been breaded and seasoned with some kind of spice blend and deep fried. Absolutely delicious, and I should really try to avoid eating too much of that whenever I visit Taiwan.
Well, fried chicken is popular. I mean, you live in South Korea, in Seoul. There are thousands of fried chicken places there, so I guess it's popular all over the world. Japan?
Everyone loves fried chicken around the world.
I think you also spoke to Chef Chuang's son. Is he going to continue being a teacher like his mother?
Chef Chuang says she will eventually retire, although she still has many students to teach, she told me. But when that day does come, her son, who goes by James, will take over the school. He was an engineer by training, but several years ago, he was tapped to inherit the school and came back to Taiwan, where his mother schooled him on how to make Taiwanese food. He told me he's ready for the responsibility of taking over his mother's school.
My name is James Jiang. Zhuang Baohua is my mom.
So you've been teaching in the school for about 7 years?
Yes. And, you know, my major is electronic engineering. So cooking is not my whole life purpose. So at first I not liked here, but a couple of years and I think Taiwanese food is 可以足以在国际扬名。
Taiwanese food can be very popular in the international.
So I have to 把所有的技术、所有的经验把它学起来，然后传承下去。
So I decide that I want to learn all the ability and all the skills to make sure that the Taiwanese food can be the best in the international world.
Yeah, did you chat with her about the difference between being a chef and then being a culinary instructor?
I asked Chef Chuang if she thought that being a good chef can automatically make you a good teacher. She didn't feel that there was a direct correlation. I think for her, teaching was something that she learned as she went along.
The good chef is not necessarily a good teacher. I find myself always learning the new recipe. I still go to night market all the time to research more different recipe to teach my student to make sure that I master this recipe for my students. So I think it's a big challenge for me transform from a chef in the kitchen to a teacher in the classroom.
So how did she get started? Was this a way to make a living? Was this just her passion in life? What was she doing before she became a culinary instructor?
Chef Chuang grew up in Taiwanese culinary culture. Her parents ran a catering business, so she always knew how to cook. But about 30 years ago, she moved to Taipei after splitting with her husband, and she needed to make ends meet to support her family. She was a single mom. So she opened up her own restaurant. But it wasn't long after that that she opened up her school. She told me that her goal was to help other women like her support their families by opening up restaurants or opening up a street food stall. And over the years, many of her students have been young entrepreneurial women.
So with over 70,000 students over her teaching decades, is there going to be 8 jillion food stalls in Taipei now? And they're all graduates of her school. Is there room for all these people to compete in the world of food in Taiwan?
Street food is a part of Taipei's culinary scene. It's a tradition that is not going away. Even though the Taiwanese are very cosmopolitan in their tastes, going to a street food market is still something that people do with their friends or their families. They pick up a bowl of steamed dumplings, some duck, deep-fried chicken patties, stinky tofu, if they will. You sit at tables outside, you have a drink. It's really a part of urban life in Taipei. And I think Chef Chuang can take some credit for keeping this tradition going. After all, she's taught tens of thousands of students over the years. I think she's been successful in installing in them a sense of this guzha way, this old-style taste that she feels is essential for keeping Taiwanese food authentic.
That was reporter Jason Strother. Guzha wei is a term for the essential flavors of classic Taiwanese cooking. But it's not just about the flavor, it also refers to how the food is prepared, slowly, with care and attention. You know, that notion that food is about the method and attitude of preparation appears all over the world, from Japan and Vietnam to Morocco and South America. It isn't just what ends up on the plate, of course, it's how it got there in the first place. So cooking is also philosophy. That may sound a tad pretentious, but it may explain why some people cook better than others. They are committed, body and soul. Right now, I'm headed into the kitchen with Lynn Clark to talk about this week's recipe.
Lynn, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. How are you?
It's summertime and I'm depressed. I mean, I like winter. I like cold weather. You know, I'm one of those people. But one reason is zucchini. It just, you know, it gets on my mind. You have all this zucchini and what are you going to do with it? zucchini boats from the 80s. Remember that?
Yes, I'm done with sadly.
That. But in Italy, here at Mill Street, remember, there is that salad, which is ribbons of zucchini, raw zucchini, into a salad. So today we're going to go use that idea, you know, ribbons of zucchini in a fresh salad.
That's right. I mean, it's summertime. Everybody has a ton of zucchini. I get it dropped off at my front door by neighbors. You want to use zucchini fresh, and this is a perfect way to do it. So this salad is really quick. It's easy to make. It's perfect for summertime. It goes alongside any kind of grilled foods that you're making. In order to get those ribbons that you talked about, you use a Y peeler, and that's the peeler that's shaped like the letter Y. The handle is the base of the Y. The blade is at the top of the Y, and you just run it down the length of zucchini. You don't have to worry too much about the size of your ribbons. It's not that important. And we kind of looked at the classics for the flavor of this, but we did look at some modern versions to kind of combine the recipes and make something a little bit different. So we took some inspiration from the River Cafe in London. They use a really bright lemon dressing on this. And then we found a few other recipes that added hazelnuts and really, really fresh herbs. So it's hazelnuts toasted. If you don't have hazelnuts, you can substitute almonds. Just make sure that the nuts are toasted. It really enhances the flavor, and you really want to maintain that crunch when you add the dressing. It's all tied together with some Parmesan cheese, handfuls of basil and mint. It's like summer in a bowl.
What do you work for, an ad agency? Nicely said. Two things. You can use a mandolin for this, like a $10 cheap plastic one. The peels are a little thicker, which I happen to like. Secondly, dress this just before serving, because if it sits, it'll tend to get a little bit watery over time. Right. Lynn, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You can find our recipe for zucchini salad at 177milkstreet.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, more of your culinary questions and dilemmas with my co-host, Sarah Moulton, after the break. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Now it's time to take some calls with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah, how are you?
Chris, I'm great, and I'm ready to go. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
My name is Jordy. I'm calling from San Jose, California.
Wonderful. How can we help you today?
This might be a silly question, but I was wondering if there was a basic quick bread, like a sweet bread recipe, that you could do, you know, using your pantry items, you know, was sturdy enough that you could spoon some jam over the top or maybe throw a handful of chocolate chips in it. And when I did my research, it either led me to like pound cake or like a cake recipe.
My go-to bread recipe is a soda bread.
Okay.
But you could add things to that, and it would certainly, with lots of butter and jam, would taste great, but just as a base. And you could add sugar, and you could do whatever you wanted. But I think a soda bread is 40 minutes, start to finish, 45 minutes. It has enough chew and heft to be a bread. Those other things are cake. Pound cake's a cake. Chiffon cake's a cake.
Well, my question was, when you said to sweeten adding chocolate chips, are you looking for a dessert or something to serve with the meal?
Like a dessert. So, like, you know, when you look it up, you have, like, chocolate bread or, like, you know, pumpkin bread, but something more basic.
Well, you know what I was going to throw out? These cream biscuits that actually something James Beard used to make, and it's really a simple recipe. It's like 2 cups of flour, a tablespoon of baking powder, a half teaspoon of table salt, and 1 to 1.5 cups heavy cream. It's just a formula you can remember. And you could add a little bit of sugar, too, if you wanted to. But then what you do is you make that, and I cut them in triangles so I don't waste anything. But you just throw it together real quick, and then you cut it into triangles, and then you cut the triangles in half, and you can throw, say, sliced fruit like strawberries that you've tossed with sugar. And, you know, just make a really quick shortcake.
The other thing you could do is a one-layer cake. During the Second World War, they're called emergency cakes, for example. Uh-huh. And some of them have no eggs in them at all. They're very simple recipes. You can do a chocolate one, which is my favorite, but you can do lots of them. And just one layer cake and an 8x8 or 9x13.
Where would you find that recipe?
I think Fannie Farmer would actually have a recipe like that. And Cook's Illustrated also has a recipe for it. By the way, you know, in Europe, they make essentially loaf cakes, which is sort of satisfies me. So they might use a little cornmeal. They might flavor it with orange. They might use a syrup on top once it comes out of the oven. And those are in a loaf pan, and they're sweet. And that's my favorite way of doing a quick dessert.
I've got another idea for a quick dessert. Does it have to be a bread?
Well, yeah, I was just looking at like something like a basic idea, but I'll take any idea you want to throw out.
Well, here's another one. You can make all sorts of fun French toasts. One of the ones I love is chocolate stuffed. So you take a couple slices of white bread and you take a couple eggs and a little bit of milk or cream and some vanilla extract and you whisk that all up, maybe throw a little sugar into it. So you dip one piece of bread into that, you put it in your nonstick pan, and then you put some chocolate. I like dark chocolate. You could also put a few raspberries on top of it, and then you take the second piece of bread, dip it again into this batter of egg and milk and vanilla extract, put it on top, squish it together, and then just saute it in butter and then cut it in triangles, put ice cream on top. Yum. My God.
I think a one-layer cake is the, or some kind of soda bread, but a one-layer cake's the way to go.
I think cream biscuits.
Oh, they're good.
There we go.
Okay.
Okay.
We've given you a bunch of ideas and we totally disagree.
I know, I was going to say, one recipe and I just walked away with, I think, five. So it's awesome. Thank you.
All right, Shorty. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Malcolm in Ithaca, New York.
How are you?
Hi, Malcolm.
I'm well. It's nice to talk to Chris and Sarah. I've been looking forward to it. My question has to do with cast iron pans and where they can be used, whether it's on a gas stove or an electric stove. I've heard that I should not use my cast iron pans on an electric stove, but I recall a few weeks ago you had a segment with Adam Gopnik, and he was happily cooking in his cast iron pans on an induction stovetop. So is it true that I can or can't use my cast iron cookware on an electric stove?
You can. The only problem with induction is you can scratch the surface sometimes, so you have to be a little careful of that. But the only thing about cast iron is it takes a long time to heat up. But you could certainly use an electric. I think Sarah cooks on electric, right?
I do. I'm stuck with electric. And, you know, when you talk about electric, I don't even know if anybody has the old coil ones anymore. They're almost all glass. And the trouble with...
Mine are coils.
Oh, they are. Well, even they could get scratched. The trouble with glass surfaces, which is what I'm stuck with, is if you have one of the old-fashioned cast irons, which have sort of a rim on the bottom, or it could have a little burr on it, it could scratch the surface, which just makes it look ugly. The other thing is cast iron's very heavy, as you know, so you might like plunk it down really hard and the glass top can break. Likewise, the coil on an electric stove is a little more delicate than what you get on a gas stove. So I would say, yeah, you could just be gentle with it. But I just wanted to clarify one thing also. Induction is not the same as electric.
I understood that.
Yeah.
But what's funny is you seem to be saying, of course, I can use my cast iron on my old style electric coils, but the danger is to the stove, not to my pan.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't hurt your cast iron pan.
No, I mean,
unless you wash it out with soap.
Yeah. Yes. No, your pan will be fine. I would like to say though, because people don't always know what kind of pans you can use on induction, because induction works by magnetism, not by open flame. That you can use cast iron on induction; it works very well.
The pan's fine. It's just how you clean it that's the problem.
Yeah,
anyway.
And just be gentle with your stove because they, you
know. With my stove. Okay.
And with your co-host. Thanks, Malcolm.
Okay, Malcolm.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you'd like your cooking questions answered, give us a ring. That's 855-426-9843. 855-426-9843. Or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Kathy.
Hi, Kathy. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Boise, Idaho.
How can we help you?
Well, I was raised on a farm, and unfortunately, we had goats, and I had bad goat milk as a kid.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah, and unfortunately, to this day, I still don't like feta or anything made out of sheep's milk, and my husband is lactose intolerant.
Oh, dear.
And I am looking for a substitute for anything that calls
for cheese.
Feta.
Well, or any cheese, I would imagine, right?
Well, my husband can take like...
Old dried cheese, the older cheese?
Yeah, like cheddar.
Like Parmesan or something.
Yeah.
Or even cheddar. That's great.
Yeah, but I like blue cheese and gorgonzola. So something that's kind of heavy in flavor to replace feta.
It's going to be one of those calls where we try to pretend we have an answer and we don't?
No, actually, I do have an answer.
What?
It's an answer we used to use a lot at Gourmet, which is ricotta salata.
Oh.
Which is aged ricotta.
Oh.
Because it's got the same texture and the same saltiness.
But if you're lactose intolerant? No.
Well.
No, that's not going to work.
Well, it's aged.
It's not aged for 2 years like Parmesan or something.
It's pretty firm. You may not be able to have it as lactose intolerant, but it's the closest I could say in flavor to feta. I would just say use just a totally different cheese. I mean, if you gave us an example of a recipe that had feta and you wanted to use something different that you all could eat, that would be helpful.
So, like, I love figs and blue cheese.
Mm. Yeah?
But he can't handle the blue cheese.
Figs and any salty cheese is good. Really, figs and Parmesan is good.
We'll just give him the figs.
The
I mean, there's a point.
Yes, is not nice.
Well, okay, but if someone's lactose intolerant, they just can't eat cheese. I mean, they can eat aged cheese, but you're not going to get a creamy gorgonzola thing going on. It's just not going to happen. Now, I remember back in the 70s, well, in the early 70s, when I was following the Grateful Dead around and had long hair and didn't wash my clothes for a couple of years, people were making cheese with tofu, right? I mean, it was like tofu and nutritional yeast and all the lemon.
There's all sorts of faux cheeses.
Yeah, there are faux cheeses using tofu. Now, I don't, compared to gorgonzola, no. But for someone who can't eat hardly any cheese, you could look into that because you would get a creamy cheese out of it. But,
yeah,
I mean,
we eat tofu. So.
Well, you eat the gorgonzola and then you can make the tofu cheese for your husband. If he wants something with that texture, I can't vouch for the flavor, but it would at least be in the ballpark of the texture. So you could try that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Maybe moose wood, the first moose wood or something.
Well, there's
as
places,
a recipe.
There's places you can just buy tofu cheese.
Okay. All right. Good.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, take care.
You too.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. Here are a few secret ways to touch up your food just before serving. Number one, salt. It's really good to keep a flaky finishing salt on hand, like Malden, for example. You sprinkle it on food just before serving. It's great on steaks and just about anything else. Lemon juice, a little bit of lemon juice at the end just before serving in a sauce, a soup, or a stew. It brightens flavor, and it also provides a little bit of citrus contrast. The next idea is adding a little bit of sweetness at the end just before serving. A little bit of honey, for example, or just white sugar can balance out other flavors and really punch them up before putting them on the table. Grated or zested ginger is also a wonderful thing to add just before serving. You can also put it over lots of Asian Indian dishes, which gives you a little bit of balance and also a little bit more complexity. And finally, something we do at Milk Street all the time is we grate garlic. A little bit of grated garlic used on a wand-style grater, you get a little bit of something mysterious and additional without that heavy garlic flavor. Wine is often put into one of two categories, that's sweet or dry. This oversimplifies a much more complex discussion, one that involves sugar, alcohol, and also flavor. So is your wine sweet or dry? Wine expert Stephen Muse has the answer. We're here at Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge. I'm here with wine expert Stephen Muse. Stephen, how are you?
Good, Chris.
We have three glasses of wine. Only one is red, and that's all I know.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I've encountered that seems to be a constant source of confusion is the seemingly simple, straightforward term dry. People come in and say, I'd like a dry wine. Or they'd say, I want a wine that's not too dry. And even though this sounds like a very simple, straightforward term, it's actually dangerously imprecise. Because for people like me who are trying to sell wine, or you're in a restaurant, talk to a sommelier, it's confusing the way this term is used. So we want to spend some time today talking about how to maybe use the term more correctly to have a better chance of getting what you want.
This is what happens when you spend so many hours in the wine corner. You just get upset. Okay, so dry is imprecise.
Yes, dry is terribly imprecise, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to show you why. So you're tasting a naturally made Prosecco, Chris, where the dead yeasts are never taken out of the bottle for the secondary fermentation, and so they just devour every scrap of grape sugar that could be left in that bottle.
I'm not going to say it's dry because I know that'll be wrong, but it's not sweet.
Right. It's bone dry.
Yeah.
It's bone dry analytically. That is, if you analyze the wine, you would find that there's just about zero residual sugar, that is sugar left over from the fermentation in that wine. But it is also perceived as being extremely unsweet. All right, there's not a scrap of sugar there. So this is a good example of a wine that we can properly call dry because there is no residual sugar in the wine.
Got it.
And it has this kind of thrilling, slightly astringent, you know, kind of
I loved it, but then again, people call me dry, so I guess I was perfectly matched to this one.
All right.
Okay.
So now we're going to taste wine number two. This is a really delicious Vouvray, and let's see what you think of that, Chris.
It's sweeter than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on. I wouldn't say it's fruity, but I would say it's sweeter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you definitely get that perception of sweetness. So let's remember that when we talk about sweetness, we're talking about one of the four or five tastes that the tongue can perceive. In this case, we're talking about a white wine that has a significant amount of residual sugar, sugar remaining in the wine from fermentation, maybe 12 or 15 grams per liter or something like that. So analytically, that is objectively, it's not a dry wine. And perceptually, it's not a dry wine because you can actually taste the sweetness in it. Right? You with me?
I feel like I'm about to head off a cliff, but yes, I'm with you. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, we're going to move on to a third wine, a red one this time.
All right.
This is a wine that's made in the Lakes District in northern Italy from a kind of a hyper-local grape there called Marzamino.
It's interesting. I mean, it has, there's a dryness in the mouth. There's a puckering quality
right.
to it. But it's has some sweetness to it.
Yeah.
But you would say it's dry in the mouth.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it has that dry quality.
Right. Okay, so this is where we approach the precipice, as you call it. So this is a wine that analytically, it's a red wine, it analytically is completely dry. We wouldn't find more than 1 or 2 grams of residual sugar if we analyze this wine. But that thing that you're perceiving as sweetness is fruit. The wine is fruity. Fruitiness in wine often masquerades as sweetness. So you put these two things together, and you can see how people can be a little bit mixed up about that. So when they come in and ask me for a dry wine, I'm thinking to myself, well, does she mean a wine that has no residual sugar in it? It's dry. Or does she mean dry, not fruity? Okay, so here are the two meanings of dry. One means not sweet, no sugar, and the other means not fruity. So what you have here in the third wine is a wine that is dry, but the fruit can make it feel as though there is some sweetness there.
So when you think about wines, how do you think about choosing a wine that has little residual sugar versus a wine with little residual sugar but has fruit to it?
Right.
What's that choice?
The choice is really what you want to drink at the moment. So the first thing that I poured you, it's a little warm here in the, it's Formaggio today, and I poured you that really nice Prosecco, chilled, thrillingly dry, and you loved it, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe as an appetizer wine, maybe as an aperitif wine, that's just really ideal on a warm day. Maybe with another kind of meal or with certain kind of appetizers, you really want something that's a little fruitier.
So dry means little residual sugar.
Yes.
And fruity is a separate characteristic that can be with a dry wine or be with another kind
That's
of wine.
Right.
But dry is just about sugar. Fruity can give the appearance and the flavor of sweetness
right.
without being sweet.
Right. So this would be fine, except for the fact that it is common to use the word dry as opposed to fruity. So here's my solution to this problem. When you're ordering wine or you're buying wine and you want wine that is dry, just say, I'd like a wine that is dry as opposed to sweet. When you want a wine that is dry, meaning not fruity, say it. I'd like a dry wine, one that's not fruity. And you're much more likely to get what you want and leave the poor fellow who's trying to make you happy in a little better position to do so.
Well, this is good. This describes us. We're both very dry and a little fruity. It's a perfect segment. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Chris.
You know, some people don't like Rieslings. They're just too sweet. Others don't like Chardonnay. They're too oaky. And Paul Giamatti's character in Sideways really hated Merlot. But of course, many Rieslings really aren't sweet, and white Burgundies are made with a Chardonnay grape and are delicious, and of course, there are good Merlot. Wine is like growing up. As a kid, you're too inexperienced to have opinions. Then, in middle age, you have nothing but opinions. And finally, when you were older, a little like me, experience has taught you that most of your opinions were just plain nonsense. So for my money, there are just two types of wine. There's good wine and there's bad wine. That's an opinion everyone can agree with. Thanks for listening to Milk Street Radio. If you missed us, you can always listen to our podcast. Of course, it's free on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or Spotify. You can go to our website at 177milkstreet.com. That's where you can download each week's recipe, get free recipes, subscribe to our magazine, watch our new TV show, it's out in September, or order our cookbook. That's it for now. We'll be back next week.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Producer Amy Padula. Production assistant Carly Helmuttag. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugars. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison with help from Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.